Our next speaker this afternoon, and of course I wish that there were five more hours in the afternoon, is Terry Noel Tao. I was a private collector, an attorney in private practice in New York. Mr. Tao reviews recordings for Opus magazine and has presented papers to many music organizations. His topic today is how Handel heard his oratorio sung, The Evidence of Recordings. Mr. Tao.
First of all, the title is slightly inaccurate. The title is How Handel Heard His Oratorio Solos Sung, The Evidence of the Recordings. Let's see, have I got that in the right place? I think so. I'm not going to make any observation on the choruses. I haven't started to work on the choruses yet. That's sort of the next part of what I'm seeking to do. The other thing is that I'm trying to push the Atlantic Ocean into a milk bottle, to crib a line that Harold Schoenberg used about Busoni's piano playing in his book, The Great Pianists. What this is a bloody chunk out of a much longer talk, which takes about 2 hours with complete recorded examples. So if it gets a little bit scrambled from time to time, I hope you'll bear with me. If I could put a quotation at the head of this, as sort of a guiding principle, I would take the profound lines that W.S. Gilbert put into the mouth of Private Willis at the beginning of the second act of Iolanthe. For every girl and every boy that's born into this world alive, he's either a little liberal or else a little conservative, fa la la. And that's true when it comes to performing artists and to recordings. I also want to say, before I get into the depths of this, that it was Randy Michelson, the vocal coach and vocal music scholar, who put me on to this particular line of research. And he gave me a good swift kick in the pants, so to speak, intellectually, to get me started on this. And I'd like to think I've taken the ball and run with it effectively. And it was Randy who pointed out to me that not enough people who study vocal records and who study vocal techniques, first of all, are prepared to admit that vocal traditions were carefully handed down, even in the face of changing styles. And second of all, that the evidence of recordings can be used to push the knowledge of performance practice much further back than the 1870s or the 1860s, which is usually thought of as that terminus ad quem, beyond which we cannot go further back. And first of all, let it be said that recordings like the rapid communications and ease of travel that we have today have resulted and began to result very quickly in a blurring and amalgamation of distinct national styles in playing and in singing. And the advent of verismo, what I call the shriek and sob school, certainly didn't help matters much either. But, and this is a big but, this is the but as tall as the Empire State Building on which the premise of this paper is based. Very early recordings do much, a very great deal, to preserve and document for us the distinct styles and schools that were still in evidence in the late 19th century throughout Europe, and styles that appear to have been handed, and I say appear, let me make that even stronger, that almost certainly were handed down very carefully from teacher to pupil, from one generation to the next, and that can be traced back well into the early 18th century, if not beyond into the late 17th century. There also appears, on the basis of both recordings and on the remarks that were made by critics, to have been a tendency to use different styles for different repertory. And I will come back to this with a vengeance when I come to the singer who's going to be the last example this afternoon. In 18th century opera, there seem to have been two predominant schools of singing. One of these was a loud declamatory style, a style that was viewed as archaic and old-fashioned even in the 18th century. The castrati, were the major exponents of this style. And I'm going to get into a contretemps with the disciple of Monsieur Lioré here by pointing out that it is unfair to pan Moreschi on the basis of the squally nature of his voice, because those records were made when he was about 15 years older than the age at which the average great castrato retired from public singing in the 18th century. Farinelli was old when he retired from the opera stage at 38. And secondly, that shouty declamatory style was deliberate. And he didn't help matters much by shrieking in St. Peter's. That's a vast space. I mean, what do you think? We can all know what that kind of space, you know, the traditional university field house has done to certain, quote, operatic, unquote, stars of today. And, I have a tendency to be bitchy. I'll try to hold that down. The other style in the 18th century was a piano pointillistic style that stressed agility, but not at the expense of expression. This was a style that was created by a castrato soprano who lost his voice but decided he was going to teach himself how to sing again. His name was Antonio Bernacchi. He was born in the same year as Handel. He taught Faustina Bordoni-Hasse, and both of them worked with Handel. And Faustina was the greatest exponent of this florid type of singing that was to have a very powerful impact on bel canto opera style. The early recordings of Irene Abendroth, for those of you who know them, the Belragio Lusinghiere, for example, that you find in the Record of Singers, is a classic example of this style. Patti was an amalgam of both, for those of you who are familiar with Patti's style of singing. Now, the next thing I wanted to touch on, now that I've laid that little bit of groundwork, so to speak, is the fact that there is, and we are fortunate in the case of Handel, that a performance tradition was carefully passed down. I made that remark about every boy and every gal who's born into this world alive is either a little liberal or else a little conservative. Well, the entire British nation seems to be a nation of little conservatives, especially when it comes to the preservation and passing down from one generation to another of any kind of a cultural form of expression which they perceive as being worthy and valuable, whether it's the cathedral style of choir singing, or Handel, who fortunately was elevated to the status of a demigod when there were still people around who remembered how Handel's music was sung. And taking that as a jumping off point, so to speak, let's examine the fact that the oratorio tradition never completely died out. It was just in its waning stages. Handel's successors in interest had just retired at the point when the famous 1784 Westminster Abbey commemoration series of performances took place. That gave a renewed burst of enthusiasm to the idea. The second thing is there was this pedagogical line of descent concept that was going all along. So let's first of all decide who were the singers that Handel used in the performances of his own oratorios. He did them on a shoestring budget. He ran those oratorio productions in a funny way, much the same way nowadays that people run Broadway shows, or more accurately, off-Broadway shows. He had some opera singers, but not very many. Gaetano Guadagni, the castrato alto, is one of the exceptions. Giulia Frasi, the soprano, is another. Caterina Galli, towards the end of Handel's career, a third. But most of them were theater singers. There were some singing actresses, like the famous Kitty Clive, who created the role of Polly in The Beggar's Opera. In other words, it would be sort of like going down to 45th Street and walking into the theater where song and dance is being given and saying to Bernadette Peters, who loves classical repertory, by the way, "Bernadette, we'd like to have you come and sing Messiah. Will you do it for us?" The other great exponent of that theater style who sang for Handel was a man named John Beard. Well, I'd like to start out by playing excerpts from two arias from what was the first go at a quote-unquote complete Messiah, 25 sides that were recorded in London in 1906 for G&T. The first is a section out of How Beautiful Are the Feet, and the second is the concluding section out of the famous tenor aria, Thou Shalt Break Them. And we'll see what happens here. There's a fade-up in the tape, by the way. Start with the How Beautiful Are the Feet. The soprano in that performance was Percival Allen. She was born in 1880 and died in 1955. Obviously, she was a very young singer at the time she made that. She takes full advantage of the Siciliano style of the song, and she uses a great deal of portamenti. It's still a very pure focused sound, but she uses a great deal of portamenti, a technique in Siciliano singing that can be traced back directly in England to Pier Francesco Tosi, who was a famous vocal coach who was living in London during Handel's first 20 years there. Surely somebody that Handel knew. What I find interesting about Percival Allen, in fact about many of the singers that are involved in the examples this afternoon, is they all also sang Wagner. It says something about how they marshaled their voices. Now, the tenor is a man named John Harrison, who was born in 1872 and died in 1929. When I played this recording at a symposium at the Manus College of Music several years ago, at which René Jacobs was on the panel with me, René turned to me and whispered in my ear while it was playing that any tenor who could get away with singing it that well today would go to the top of the early music profession. And I'm sure that those of you who are into Handel and cadential flourishes and that noticed that distinct interpolation of a short cadential flourish at the end. And that is one of the few vestiges of the cadential practice, some indication of the fact that it held on. Now, both of these singers, what other differences you may notice, whatever similarities you may notice to modern style. Both of these singers interpret this music in a clear, focused way, with vibrato used largely as an embellishment, and it is a style that seems archaic within the context of the time. Now, I'm going to turn to the question of the pedagogical pedigree. While recordings did a lot of damage in blurring distinct national styles because the singer in London could find out what Puccini's favorite tenor in Milan was doing within 6 months of the premiere of a Puccini opera simply by listening to a flat disc or a cylinder, things began to blur very quickly. But as I said before, recordings are also an important body and little used body of evidence for the preservation of styles. And they can also be used to demonstrate how a style can be transmitted by teacher to pupil with very little change. The excerpt is the first verse, if you will, out of Non più andrai from The Marriage of Figaro. Translation that's coming up is dreadful, but forgive them.
Now your days of philandering are over. No more spring from flower to flower. You're no more as a maiden's young rover. Play Adonis to each pretty maid. You're no more as a maiden's young rover. Play Adonis to each pretty maid. All thy dainty belongings, cap be plumed, and thy gewgaws and laces, shear thy locks, thou need of such graces. Soon these lilies and roses shall fade, soon these lilies and roses shall fade. Now put off thy gay belongings, cap be plumed, gauze and laces, thou need of such graces. Days of philandering are over. No more straying from flower to flower. You're no more as a maiden's young rover. Play Adonis to each pretty maid. You're no more as a maiden's young rover. Play Adonis to each pretty maid. Now mid warriors grim carousing, long moustache and beard imposing, while your knapsack.
The pupil, Peter Dawson, the great antipodeal bass baritone, one of the greatest singers, English language singers of the 20th century, without question, the teacher, Sir Charles Sampley. Now, obviously, Peter Dawson was making concessions to the changing taste, and the voices have their own distinct character. But Dawson learned that aria and the style of it from Sampley with unerring and uncanny accuracy and managed to carry it over in practical whole and certainly in the overwhelming major part. What's important about that, apart from the fact that this shows how a teacher can copycat something valuable that was passed to him, a pupil can copycat something valuable that was passed to him by his teacher? Well, the thing that's valuable about it is Santley's own pedigree. He was taught by Garcia the Younger, who of course was the pupil of his father, Garcia Sr., who in turn had been a pupil of Giovanni Anzani. Now, Anzani had been, like Joseph Haydn, a pupil of the notorious Nicola Porpora, who was Farinelli's bosom buddy and Handel's great rival in London, and also one of the great vocal coaches of the time. Now, Santley, of course, also had a direct line to Lorenzo da Ponte, which makes his Mozart singing particularly valuable. What wouldn't we give for the Gounod aria that Gounod wrote for him? But that's besides the point. You take what you get. It's serendipitous, this business, isn't it? But anyway, now that I've done that, and since I'm running the clock and am now getting to what Alfred Hitchcock used to call the MacGuffin, I want to turn to a gentleman who was perhaps the greatest English tenor of the 19th century, Elgar's favorite gerontius, and a Handelian too, as I shall show. It's a man named Edward Lloyd, who was born in 1845 and who died in 1927. Now, Mr. Lloyd graduated from Cambridge and took up a career as a singer. He was also, however, a product of the Westminster Abbey Cathedral Choir School. And that's where things become interesting. Because that pedigree is extraordinary. Lloyd's teacher, vocal coach, the choir master, the master of the choristers at Westminster Abbey, was a man named James Turrell. Now, Turrell was famous at his time as a vocal coach, and he trained many of the great English tenors of the time. He had been for 12 years the assistant to Thomas Greatorex, organist and master of the Chapel Royal, a master of the choristers, rather, in Westminster Abbey, who had been a colleague of the notorious Joah Bates, who organized the 1784 Handel commemoration. Greatorex, in turn, had been a student of Benjamin Cook. Now, Cook was a student of the famous Pepusch, who wrote the Beggar's Opera, who was one of the most conservative musicians in London at the time, and Mr. Cook was also a close friend and colleague of Handel's good friend, Robinson, Dr. Robinson, who was the organist in Westminster Abbey. Now, who taught Benjamin Cook? And who was Benjamin Cook's predecessor in the Abbey? None other than Bernard Gates. Now, Bernard Gates was a colleague of Handel's, close friend of Handel's, the master of the Chapel Royal Choir as well, and it was Gates who provided all of the boys for the choruses in the Handel oratorios. In addition, Mr. Gates taught John Beard, who was Handel's favorite tenor, the tenor for whom most, if not all, of the great tenor parts in the dramatic oratorios were written. Now, Mr. Lloyd made some 20 or 30 sides. I'm going to give you an example of a standard one. Gounod thought that Lloyd was absolutely the lobster's dress shirt, to use a line out of Lord Peter Wimsey, one of the best tenors he'd ever heard. So it's fortunate that we have a Gounod aria as a sample. This is from the Queen of Sheba. This also fades up and...
Oh, right.
As I said, Mr. Lloyd made some 20 or 30 sides, and that is typical of the vast, overwhelming majority of them. That is sung in the prevailing late 19th century pre-verismo style that was advocated by the Garcias father and son. A smooth, silken legato, largely non-syllabic, but with very clear diction. Now, as I said, the vast majority are sung this way. There are two records of Edward Lloyd's that are not. What are those two records? The first is a record of The Death of Nelson, a ballad written by John Braham, who was a famous English concert tenor of the first half of the 19th century, who also had a tenuous but still direct line from Beard. And the other is, and here is the MacGuffin, Sound an Alarm from Judas Maccabeus. When I gave this talk for the first time at that symposium at Manus, I said in introducing the Braham Death of Nelson and in pointing out that this is sung in that shouty, declamatory, syllabic, theatrical style to which I had referred at the very beginning as being a theater style, as also being an archaic style linked to the castratos, I said, what I wouldn't give for the sound and alarm, because that's the whole purpose, is Handel, early 18th century practice. Well, my good friend Tom Clear, who many of you know, was sitting in the audience. And Tom came up to me afterwards and said, why didn't you tell me you've been looking for that record? I've had it for 30 years. And sure enough, the next week when I met him for breakfast, he made me a present of this recording. And when I got it home, I couldn't wait to get home from the office. When I got it home and put it on the turntable and heard the first phrase out of Edward Lloyd's mouth, thanks to this wonderful acoustic record, I got goosebumps. I still do, even thinking about it. I commend to you that this is in large measure the style, if not the sound, that George Frideric Handel heard in the Theatre Royal in Covent Garden in 1747 when John Beard sang Sound an Alarm for the first time.
My arms against his forehead will I call. He deal me a covenant, how cold, how vain, how ineffective his design. While rage is legal, and Jehovah mine. Sound an alarm, your silver trumpet sound, and call the brave as only brave, and only brave around. Call the brave, call the brave, and only brave around. Sound an alarm, your silver trumpet sound, your trumpet sound, your trumpet sound, and call the brave and only brave, and call the brave and only brave, and only brave around.
Sound an
alarm.
Tenors, basses, sopranos, and contraltos, let them do what they never do, and that is to seek out and study the early records, and to study them in connection with the scholarly sources, the treatises, and let them not assume, because, as it says in the Bad News Bears, to assume is to make an ass of you and me. Let them not assume that the recording cannot carry us back beyond 1877, beyond 1834, that it cannot carry us back into the 18th century. I submit that it does, and I submit that that is the record that proves it. Thank you very much.